The Blind Californian, quarterly magazine of the California Council of the Blind, Fall 2014, Volume 58, Number 4. Published in Braille, large print, cassette, email, bc-subscribe@ccbnet.org, and online in readable and downloadable text and audio media. Recorded by the volunteers of the Northern California Studio of Learning Ally. Jeff Tom, President, 7414 Mooncrest Way, Sacramento, California, 95831. 916-429-8201. jeff.thom@ccbnet.org. Executive Office, California Council of the Blind, 1303 J Street, Suite 400, Sacramento, California, 95814-2900, 800-221-6359, toll-free, 916-441-2100, voice, 916-441-2100. 88 fax, email ccotb@ccbnet.org, website ccbnet.org, San Francisco Bay Area Office, Catherine Skivers, 836 Risotto Street, Hayward, California, 94545-2120, 510-357-1986. CATHIE.SKIVERS@ccbnet.org. Los Angeles Area Office, Donna Pomerantz, 1115 Cordova Street, number 402, Pasadena, California, 91106-3036, 626-844-4388. donna.pomerantz@ccbnet.org. Mitch Pomerantz, Director, Advocacy and Governmental Affairs, 800-221-6359, toll-free, 626-672-5150, cell, governmentalaffairs@ccbnet.org. Webmaster@ccbnet.org. Judy Wilkinson, Editor, 1550 Bancroft Avenue, number 113, San Leandro, California, 94577-5264. 510-357-1844. editor@ccbnet.org. Susan Glass, Associate Editor, 408-257-1034, editor@ccbnet.org. The California Connection is a weekly news service provided by phone in English and Spanish at 800-221-6359, Monday through Friday after 4 p.m., and all day on weekends and holidays. By email subscription, send a blank message to connection-subscribe@ccbnet.org or on the web at ccbnet.org. Submissions for the California Connection can be emailed to ca.connection@ccbnet.org. Non-members are requested and members are invited to pay a yearly subscription fee of $10 toward the production of The Blind Californian. If you or a friend would like to remember the California Council of the Blind in your will, you can do so by employing the following language. I give, devise, and bequeath unto the California Council of the Blind, a nonprofit charitable organization in California, the sum of blank or blank, to be used for its worthy purposes on behalf of blind persons. If your wishes are more complex, you may have your attorney communicate with the executive office for other suggested forms. Thank you. In accepting material for The Blind Californian, priority will be given to articles concerning the activities and policies of the California Council of the Blind and to the experiences and concerns of blind persons. Recommended length is under 3 pages or 1,800 words. The deadline to submit material for the winter 2015 issue of The Blind Californian is noon on Friday, November 21, 2014. Please send all address changes to Executive Office. Table of Contents. From the Editor's Desk by Judy Wilkinson. 5. President's Message, Something for Everyone by Jeff Tom. 8. Spring Conference Convention, California Council of the Blind by Patricia Nash. 11. Sierra Regional Ski for Light Schedule by Betsy Rowell. 20. Business Minutes, Fall 2013 CCB Convention at the Del Mar Marriott Hotel by Gabe Griffith, CCB Secretary, through 2013. 22. CCB Governmental Affairs by Mitch Pomerantz. 26. Dr. Newell Perry Remembered, excerpt from the 50th anniversary of CCB by Catherine Skivers. 30. California Council of the Blind, CCB, Strategic Plan, 2013 to 2016, by Board of Directors. 50. California Council of the Blind, 2014 Officers and Board, 56. Page 5. From the Editor's Desk, by Judy Wilkinson. All year, we've been trumpeting the fact that the Council is 80 this year. Actually, the CCB is 80 on October 6, 2014. See Catherine Skiber's article, Founding of the California Council of the Blind, in the BC Winter 2014 issue for a transcript of the minutes which founded the organization. Almost a third of this issue presents an address by Dr. Jacobus Tenbroek, in honor of Dr. Newell Perry. We couldn't think of a more fitting way to celebrate CCB's birthday. Read the address and you'll know why we exist. Hard on the heels of his hard work chairing the Sacramento region's successfully completed 4th annual Mutt Strut, President Jeff Tom further reminds us of why we have been here 80 years and what we might consider doing in the future. Page 6. What more fitting way to celebrate our birthday than to present CCB's strategic plan for at least the next 5 years? We will include the goals of the plan over the next 2 issues. As you read it, think of where your skills and interests could benefit the organization and let Jeff know. And now a surprise announcement. Those who perused the masthead or grammarians in the crowd who carefully read the title of this column may have gotten a clue. My name is Susan Glass, and I am both delighted and honored to join Judy Wilkinson as the Blind Californian's associate editor. I want to thank my colleagues on the CCB Publications Committee for entrusting me with this responsibility, and I hope that my service on the BC will confirm that your trust is well placed. A bit about me. I'm recently retired from my full-time position as an English and Women's Studies professor at West Valley Community College. I live with my husband, John Glass, and my guide dog, Zeus, in Saratoga, California. Both John and I are active members of the Silicon Valley Council of the Blind. John is currently vice president of our chapter, and I am program chair and editor of our newsletter, In Touch. I like singing, writing, playing the harp, hiking, and birding by ear. I also like dark chocolate. Page 7. Recently, Linda Porell, Judy Wilkinson, and I met by phone to brainstorm what we thought would be the best roles and responsibilities for an associate editor. One strategic goal of the BC is to promote CCB membership and chapter growth. To that end, we'd like to feature the activities of an individual chapter in each issue of the BC. As associate editor, I will be reaching out to chapter presidents to learn about your chapter's projects and goals. Over a 3-year cycle of BC publishing, we hope to feature every chapter and every affiliate. In other words, we'd like to create a chapter spotlight column. So if your chapter has done or is doing something about which you're enthused, please contact me by email at susancglass@att.net or by phone at 408-429-9567. We also want to feature individuals who are doing inspiring work in the blind community. I will be interviewing people for these articles as well. By the way, did you know that the CCB website features a Hall of Fame honoring blind individuals who have provided outstanding leadership and service in CCB, ACB, and the blindness community in general? Its roster is impressive and features folks from all walks of life. Take a look. Essentially, I will be the BC's roving editor, interviewing, researching, brainstorming, and gathering ideas for interesting features. Judy and I will also collaborate on planning and assembling each issue, and I will support her in whatever ways I can be most helpful. To think that Susan and I, who shared the exact same career, professors of English at community colleges, should now join forces. You will have a better blind Californian as a result. Though Susan gave her personal email, you can always reach both your editors at editor@ccbnet.org. I am incredibly pleased as we begin Volume 59, Number 1, with the winter issue to be joined by such a skilled associate editor. Welcome aboard, Susan. Page 8. President's Message, Something for Everyone, by Jeff Tom. How many times have you heard CCB members say that a chapter should be primarily concerned with advocacy and related work in the community? On the other hand, how many times have you heard the view that social functions are every bit as, and maybe more, important? Perhaps even more to the point, there are members who feel that even though advocacy is a good thing, it just isn't for me for one reason or another, so let the other folks do it. Moreover, there are those who insist that if members want social functions, that's fine, but just leave me out of it. Page 9. The theme of this article is a simple one. Those who limit themselves to either the advocacy side of things or the social side are both doing CCB a disservice, even though they likely do not realize it. For 80 years, our mission has been and is to improve the lives of persons who are blind or who have low vision. At the core of this mission has always been advocating on behalf of persons with visual impairments, whether this means going before Congress, the state legislature, or the city council or county board of supervisors, advocating before federal, state, or local administrative agencies, going to court, or working in many other ways to assist the members of our community, CCB has always been at the forefront. Some people have a real love for engaging in such work, while others either don't care about it or are not convinced they can really do the job when it comes to advocacy. At the other end of the spectrum, many people love getting together with other persons who are blind or who have low vision just to have fun. Pizza parties, bingo games, Tupperware or pampered chef parties, movie nights, picnics, jaunts to a casino, or a baseball game. The list is endless. They just enjoy the comradeship of others that have visual impairments. And yet, some of those who work tirelessly to help those with vision loss just don't want to get involved in this type of activity with other CCB members. Page 10. So what's wrong with this picture? What's the problem with a different strokes for different folks attitude? In theory, nothing. But practically speaking, I would argue that each group sends a harmful message to the other. Those who enjoy the social functions but avoid advocacy at all cost make those advocates feel like the entire burden of the chapter's work is upon them. Why should we work so hard when those folks don't do any work? One argument made by those who don't want to work on any type of advocacy is that I am just no good at it. Well, You don't need to have a silver tongue or be able to write a novel. If you go to your transit district meeting when bus service is being reduced and just sit with your colleagues who are talking, or maybe just say a few words about how losing that bus line is going to hurt you, that's all you need to do. It isn't that hard, and it makes a real difference. Moreover, it really makes the hardcore advocates feel that you are in the boat with them. On the other side of the fence, those who never attend social functions make others begin to wonder whether somehow those who stay away consider themselves better than the rest of the members. People have busy lives and many competing priorities, but it is important to show how much you value your colleagues by participating in at least some of the social events. Advocacy and social functions are both perceived as important goals. A stronger sense of unity can develop among all chapter members. And isn't this what all of us really want? So if you have a comfort zone as either an advocate or a participant in social functions, jump outside that comfort zone, and you'll be doing everyone, and even yourself, a big favor. Page 11. Spring Conference Convention, California Council of the Blind, by Patricia Nash. Editor's note, however much you might have enjoyed reading Ken Metz's article, Out of the Doghouse, in the spring issue of the BC, and however delighted you may have been that Guide Dog Users of California has once again become a vital active affiliate, you probably didn't want to read it twice, especially under Patty Nash's promised article on the Spring Conference Convention. Once the horrible truth was brought to my attention, Annette Carter, who has been doing our layout beginning with the spring issue, and I tried to sleuth out how, why this could have happened. As is sometimes necessary, because of space restrictions, we slot articles in and out at the last minute. Well, what can I say? Those computer gremlins sneaked in and did a bait and switch. No excuses. We blank-ed up. Page 12. I've known Patty's writing since she served as Bayview Chapter's secretary for several years. As soon as she was elected as our delegate, I tapped her to write this convention article. So often I must wheedle or twist arms, but Patty enthusiastically agreed to the assignment. She gave a fine report at our chapter meeting the Saturday following convention, and here then, albeit belatedly, is her thoughtful report. The annual conference and convention of the California Council of the Blind was held from Thursday, April 10 to Sunday, April 13, 2014, at the Arden West Hilton Hotel in Sacramento. The theme of the conference was Celebrating 80 Years of Achievement, Advocacy, Accessibility, and was suggested by Vita Zavoli, TOG Chair and Board Member. It was hosted by the Capital Chapter and was different from other years, being the first annual conference convention for CCB. Page 13. The Board of Directors meeting was held on Thursday, noon, and it lasted a grueling 4 hours, but much was accomplished. The meeting was presided over by President Donna Pomerantz, and many committee reports were given. First, the agenda for the meeting was read by Secretary Judy Wilkinson and approved. Then there were reports on the Mutt Strutt, Ellen Murphy Fund, Noel Perry, Budget and Finance, the TOG Committee, which is responsible for the maintenance of the entire CCB website, Facebook and Twitter, and California Connection. Most board members have responsibilities for specific committees, and the tasks they perform are daunting, including ensuring we have affordable, comfortable, and accessible accommodations for our future conferences. In the Publications Committee report, we learned that the cost for printing The Blind Californian is $12,000 per year, and though a survey was taken of the membership to determine which formats we could receive it in if Braille or cassette copies were discontinued, we were assured that at this time neither format will be discontinued. Maintenance costs are rising as our economy tries to recoup from the recession of 2008. Page 14. Jeff Tom thanked Donna for a good job conducting the board meeting. She said that help from each and every member of our organization is needed to carry out our goals and to make our ideas a reality and our organization what we want it to be. So we should stay informed and keep working. She also thanked everyone for their hard work. Frank Welty suggested that in odd-numbered years, the convention should be held up north so that the new legislative session could work on bills and they would gain momentum. I was inspired to hear that Al Gill has been a member of CCB for 63 years, and he donated money to continue our work, and his wife Connie made a $500 donation to the Blind Californian. In the first general session on Friday afternoon, we first heard from Mark Lees of the California Department of Business Oversight, who talked about protecting yourself from financial fraud. Personal information can be collected bit by bit, over time, to steal one's identity. Some safeguards we can take are burning or shredding mail, even just with your name and address on it, picking up mail on time, and being careful what you share on the Internet. There is a toll-free call center, 866-275-2677, or go to dbo.ca.gov. We next heard from Albert Ritzy from My Blind Spot, who told about his work partnering with Adaptive Technology Services to make QuickBooks accessible to accountants, and the goal would be to tailor the products to our needs first without having to make them accessible later. A demonstration of writing a check was given. Information can be obtained from myblindspot.org. Page 15. We heard from a representative from Covered California, and she was informed that all materials provided by a state-run health organization should be in an accessible format. Friday evening, I attended the President's Dinner, which was a candidates' forum. Though it was enjoyable and informative and necessary, I missed hearing what the chapters were doing for special projects. They are always a source of inspiration. Friday evening session began with a moment of silence for those members who had passed on during the past year. At this time, Donna Pomerantz recognized the three silver sponsors of the conference convention, Vanda Pharmaceuticals, Lainey Feingold, and Linda Dardarian. Donna stated that our history has been marvelous and who knows where we'll be in the next 80 years. Pam Pelagi announced the slate of officers to be voted on, and they were President Jeff Tom, First Vice President Eugene Lozano, Jr., Treasurer Peter Pardini. The directors were Vincent Calderon, Lena Dawes, Frank Welty, and Paul Patch, Jr. She then gave the credentials report, and 14 chapters were not seated at this convention. Page 16. Jean Lozano next introduced Dr. Melissa Oliva-Doty, who gave us an update on non-24-hour sleep disorder and its treatment in people with no light perception. She works with Vanda Pharmaceuticals as their medical science liaison in Washington, D.C. She announced that the new treatment of this disorder was approved this day, April 12, 2014. Circadian rhythms are built into our bodies by certain environmental factors, of the primary one being daylight. Our body wants to be on a 25-hour day. To make adjustments, our body shifts the time from 10 minutes to up to an hour. The eyes send messages to the brain on light and darkness to reset our body clock each day. Each cell has a time clock, and they are all on the same timing. Light and darkness signal the hormones for sleep. So it's like the atomic clock. Our clock is advancing, so our body will fight us if we try to go by the clock. This can result in naps during the day and wakefulness at night. Retraining your body is not enough to counteract the impact of no light stimulus to the brain center. The company is working with insurance companies to put the treatment on their formularies. Vanda is committed to get help to those patients who need the treatment even if they can't afford the cost. The name of the drug is HETLIOZ. Page 17. Many of us are diagnosed with insomnia because doctors are not aware of this disorder, and much publicity is going out to remedy this, and there is a website to which doctors can go for information. Jeff Tom gave a very thorough legislative report. See his report elsewhere in this issue. He also updated us on structured negotiations, including accessible credit reports. Get yours at creditreport.com. More accessible banking, including statements and accessible ATMs, great accessibility of Weight Watchers, and CVS.com has mail order prescriptions. You can also obtain script talcs from Envision America. Ron Brooks, member of the ACB Board of Publications, was the ACB representative. A former member of CCB, now from Arizona, he gave the national ACB report. He spoke about legislation in education, which would ensure children have accessible materials in elementary school. He said Braille is much more accessible in other countries. Braille labels are on groceries and food, even wine bottles. Donna gave her moving final president's report. She spoke about recent CCB activities and thanked everyone for their support. She expressed her sorrow at having to leave office sooner than she had wanted to. Page 18. We next had the election of officers and directors. All candidates were voted in by acclamation. This year, on Saturday, there was no afternoon session, but instead two simultaneous tracks. One on employment. I attended the leadership training track, which was really informative and fun. If you do get a chance to attend the convention, you should go. Lena Dawes, Jeff Tom, Mitch Pomerantz, and Frank Welty provided an excellent forum for learning. There was much information to bring back to the chapter, with wise advice and an opportunity for participation. We were advised that keeping our eye on the prize and being a fine example by working hard were essential to leadership. A good leader is determined by the results he gets. We were given tips on conducting meetings, familiarizing ourselves with Robert's Rules of Order. We learned that each person has a niche, and there are jobs for all types of people. We are working for advocacy and do not need to get into personalities. Lena facilitated the next part, and we broke into groups. She asked if we were formal or informal, domineering or easygoing, and then we had to answer questions, and learned a whole lot about personality types. This was my favorite activity of the convention, and I learned the most from it to use in interacting with personalities in my workplace and my local chapter. Page 19. Saturday night is banquet time. I was honored to sit with Leslie and Jeff Tom. Ron Brooks was an excellent master of ceremonies and introduced the presenters and speakers. The banquet was uplifting, enjoyable, and touching. He first introduced all of the LIFE members. And when Donna was going to pay her $100 donation to add her name to this list, Artis Bazin presented her with a LIFE membership to which many contributed. Next, Artis wore her hat as chair of the membership committee. She presented chapter growth awards to CLUA for the most new members and to GDUC for the greatest percentage increase. Humboldt Chapter received the Chapter of the Year award for their getting audio-described movies in their local theaters. Margie Donovan received a humanitarian award for getting audio-described musical productions into the theater, including a special time which people could see the costumes and props. Richard Lewis also received an award for making these productions accessible. Linda Porrell gave publication committee awards to Vita Zavoli for her issue-oriented article on employment and to Alice McGrath for her lifestyle article on the Braille Challenge. Ed Branch read all of the plaques. Mitch Pomerantz's name was added to the California Council's Hall of Fame, which is a plaque which hangs in the state office and contains the plaque with each name on them. Artis Bazin also presented a charter to the Greater Lakewood Chapter, and then Ron Brooks presented Albert Ritzy, who spoke about his struggles adjusting to blindness. Thanks to his family, he always knew he was a leader and not a quitter. He is a promoter of accessibility. Sunday morning was taken up with resolutions. See Jeff's article summary elsewhere in this issue. The treasurer's report was given, constitutional amendments were presented, and we are all very grateful to Donna Pomerantz for her dedication to CCB. Page 20. Sierra Regional Ski for Light Schedule by Betsy Rowell. Sierra Regional Ski for Light, srsfl.org, is accepting applications for the 2015 ski season at Tahoe Donner Cross Country in Truckee, California. SRSFL offers guided cross-country skiing and snowshoeing for blind and visually impaired children and adults. Each skier and snowshoer is matched with a trained guide. SRSFL welcomes beginners to advanced skiers. Scholarships are available. Fee includes transportation from Sacramento. Page 21. 2015 ski schedules. Saturday day trips. January 24, sign-up deadline, January 17. February 7, sign-up deadline, January 31. March 21, sign-up deadline, March 14. Fees for day trips. Adults, 13 to 74, $39, $19 if you have skis. Seniors, 60 to 74, $36, $16 if you have skis. Children 12 and under, $12. Super seniors 75 and older, $25, $5 if you have skis. Contact Betsy Roll, SRSFL Skier Day Trip Coordinator, at 916-362-5557. Email betsy.roell2@gmail.com. 23rd Annual 3-Day Event, Adults Only, Saturday, February 28 through Monday, March 2, 2015. Lodging will be at the Hotel Truckee Tahoe, Truckee, California. Skiing will be at Tahoe Donner Cross Country, Truckee, California. Cost $275, $218 if you bring equipment. Fee includes 2 nights lodging, double occupancy, 2 breakfasts, 2 dinners, trail passes, and transportation. Lodging at the Fairfield Inn and Suites in Rancho Cordova Friday night, February 27, an additional $43 double, $86 single. Contact Cindy Quintana, SRSFL 3-Day Event Coordinator, at 510-483-2948. Email cindyq12345@sbcglobal.net. Page 22. Business Minutes. Fall 2013 CCB Convention at the Del Mar Marriott Hotel by Gabe Griffith, CCB Secretary, through 2013. Editor's note, unfortunately, this article got bumped in the summer BC, but as with all our minute summaries, it is important historically, especially as the last of our semi-annual conventions. Friday. Credentials. Pam Pelagi presented the credentials report. The chapters that were not seated were Antelope Valley Chapter, Golden Gate Chapter, Greater Lakewood Chapter, High Desert Chapter, Humboldt County Chapter, Inland Empire Chapter, and Solano County Chapter. Motion, it was moved and seconded to approve the Credentials Committee report. The motion passed unanimously. Elections. The following officers and directors were elected to the CCB Board of Directors. Roger Peterson, Second Vice President, Judy Wilkinson, Secretary, Artis Bazin, Director, John Ross, Director, Linda Perel, Director, Robert Wendt, Director, and Vita Zavoli, Director. Page 23. Saturday. Constitution and Bylaws. Gabe Griffith gave the second reading of several amendments. All proposed amendments passed. The amended sections were Article 17, Constitutional Amendments, Article 4, Newell Perry Endowment Trust, Article 10.4, Board of Directors Composition. Gabe then gave a first reading of several more amendments to be voted on Sunday morning. Sunday. Gabe read the business minutes from the Spring 2013 Convention. Motion, it was moved and seconded to approve the minutes. The motion passed. Constitution and Bylaws Revisited. Gabe gave the second reading of several amendments. The amendments were all part of Article 8. The amended sections of the Constitution were 8.2, 8.6, 8.7, and 8.9. There was also the creation of a new bylaw, number 4, specifying the membership and officer sheet, officer and membership lists. Motion. It was moved and seconded to adopt the Constitution and Bylaws Committee report. The motion passed. Page 24. Resolutions. Jeff Tom read the resolutions. Following is a list of the resolutions and the action taken. 2013 B1 State Board of Guide Dogs for the Blind. Pass. 2013 B2 IHSS Reader Services. Pass. 2013 B3 Department of Rehabilitation Purchasing. Pass. 2013 B4 Volunteers. Pass. 2013 B5 BEP. Pass. 2013 B6 Guide Dog Users of California. Pass. 2013 B7 Hotel Appreciation. Pass. Motion. It was moved and seconded to accept the Resolutions Committee report. The motion passed. Treasurer's Report. Peter Pardini gave the Treasurer's Report. Total assets are $1,057,243. The full report is available by contacting the CCB office. Motion. It was moved and seconded to accept the Treasurer's Report. The motion passed. Committee Reports. Publications. Linda Porel announced a survey that is in the BC regarding future formats. Page 25. Membership. Artis Bazin asked all chapters and affiliates to send her the email addresses for 2 members of their chapters for the membership email list. Credentials. Pam Pelagi thanked everyone for getting their information in on time, and Ed for all his help. TOG. Asked people to fill out the survey on web content and announced that the website may be down while it is being migrated to another service. New business. Margie Donovan announced that she feels there should be a flag at the front of the room during the Pledge of Allegiance. Mitch said there could be problems due to storage. Jeff suggested encouraging the Convention Planning Committee to urge scout troops and other color guards in local areas to bring in a flag. Jean said the committee already does this. Motion. Margie moved that if there is not a flag in the front of the room, that the Pledge of Allegiance be suspended. The motion was seconded. The motion failed. Pam Metz thanked the GDUC board for all their work over the summer and the CCB board for their support. Old business. There was no old business. Public comments. Mike Keithley thanked the people responsible for keeping the ALD system going. Christy Crespin wanted to know what to do with name badges. The next convention will be in Sacramento at the Arden West Hilton Hotel from April 10 through the 13th, 2014. Page 26. CCB Governmental Affairs by Mitch Pomerantz. With Jeff Tom assuming the presidency of the California Council of the Blind, I was asked and accepted appointment to chair the CCB Governmental Affairs Committee. As someone who has been an advocate on behalf of blind and visually impaired persons for over 40 years, as well as a longtime student of the U.S. and California political scenes, I was honored by President Tom's appointment and look forward to the challenge during the upcoming 2 years. And challenge it will be, since I reside in Southern California rather than where the action is in Sacramento. Nonetheless, the President and I have worked out a plan which should accommodate CCB's advocacy activities satisfactorily. Page 27. We have done a bit of streamlining of the committee, reducing the number of voting members to 10. They are Artis Bazin, Lena Dawes, Margie Donovan, Roy Harmon, Alice McGrath, Stephen Mendelssohn, Charles Nabarette, Teddy Joy Remhild, Robert Wendt, and yours truly, Mitch Pomerantz. While the committee is somewhat smaller in size, I want to strongly encourage each CCB chapter to appoint an advocacy representative who can participate on our email list, ccbgal@ccbnet.org, and in teleconference meetings when those are scheduled. Whether you are a member of the Governmental Affairs Committee or not, you will play a key role in promoting CCB's legislative agenda. Now for an update relative to state and federal legislation of interest to the Council. Unfortunately, there is nothing new to report on the 2 pieces of federal legislation being championed by the American Council of the Blind, H.R. 3749, which would establish demonstration projects under Medicare for the purchase of low-vision aids and devices costing more than $500, and H.R. 4040, which would institute a wide range of important reforms for the education of blind, low-vision, deaf, and hard-of-hearing children. Neither bill attracted sufficient co-sponsors during the current session of Congress to move beyond the bill introduction stage of the legislative process, so will be reintroduced in 2015 by ACB. It will be critical for our chapters to reach out to their members of Congress to educate them about the importance of both bills to constituents in their districts, both young and old. Page 28. An initiative which CCB has been supporting for several years, including reading and document completion as an IHSS, in-home support services, benefit, was drafted as AB 1703. It ran into trouble in the Senate Appropriations Committee thanks to an unfavorable cost estimate by the Department of Finance. As a result, the bill was not removed from the suspense file and died in committee for this session. Another bill which CCB supported, AB 1602, would have required Caltrans rather than BEP, Business Enterprise Program, vendors operating roadside rest area facilities to pay the utility costs associated with those facilities located on state property. Once again, the bill hit a roadblock in Senate appropriations and is dead for this legislative session. CCB will work collaboratively with the Randolph Shepherd Vendors of California and others to get passage of this vital legislation during the upcoming legislative session. Page 29. And finally, AB 1193, which would allow local governments to develop and implement their own standards for the establishment and regulation of bicycle lanes, or cycle tracks, was initially opposed by CCB. The problem, as we saw it, was that there would be no uniformity from community to community. As an example, several municipalities are permitting cycle tracks between the sidewalk and where vehicles can park. CCB saw this as problematic from a pedestrian safety perspective. Ultimately, we took a neutral position when Caltrans agreed to involve its existing advisory committee dedicated to improving access for persons with disabilities. That entity will develop guidelines which local jurisdictions will be encouraged to follow in establishing cycle tracks. Not surprisingly, here in California, the bicycle lobby is very strong, and AB 1193 has passed and was signed by Governor Brown. It goes without saying that you, our members, need to pay close attention to what is happening in your local communities and be prepared to attend City Council meetings where regulations for such bike lanes are being discussed. If you don't speak out at such meetings, you may learn the hard way about cycle tracks and the hazards they present. While it was a difficult legislative year for CCB, I assume my new position with considerable optimism. We are veterans of the advocacy movement, and we know that getting what we need often takes time and effort. Please join me and the Governmental Affairs Committee in putting forth the time and effort to make the lives of blind and visually impaired persons residing in California better. Page 30. Dr. Newell Perry Remembered. Excerpt from the 50th Anniversary of CCB by Catherine Skivers. Editor's Note. In the summer BC, we presented the notice about Dr. Newell Perry's induction into the American Printing House's Hall of Fame for leaders and legends of the blindness field. As a fitting tribute to Dr. Perry in the founding month 80 years ago of the California Council of the Blind, Catherine Skivers, in her ongoing presentation of historically relevant material, submits the following address. Though longer than usual, I think you will find it well worth the space we give it. Kathy writes, "The blind men and women of California and of the nation have been, in a very real sense, the beneficiaries of Dr. Newell Perry's lifetime of unceasing effort in their behalf." Page 31. Dr. Perry died in 1961. At a memorial convocation held at the California School for the Blind in Berkeley on March 25, 1961, Jacobus Tenbrook delivered the address entitled, "Newell Perry, Teacher of Youth and Leader of Men." This sensitive, perceptive tribute gives such an insight into the contribution of Dr. Newell Perry and into the character of his most distinguished student that it must be given in full. I come before you today, indeed, we are all gathered here to discharge a public duty and to honor a private debt. Newell Perry was a public figure. To us, he was also a personal friend. We can appraise his public contribution. We can only acknowledge our private obligation and personal attachment. We can detail his public record, define his influential role, itemize his accomplishments, recount his deeds, enumerate his statutes, specify his doctrines, disentangle the elements of his social philosophy, identify the general and the institutional fruits of his life's work, analyze and psychoanalyze the personality traits that made him a leader. Upon the life we shared, we can only dwell in memory, sifting through the loose meshes of the mind, the hours, the days, the nights, the months, the years of our common experience, the fears, the travails, the aspirations, the laughter that were ours together. Page 32. We were his students, his family, his intimates, his comrades on 1,000 battlefronts of a social movement. We slept in his house, ate at his table, learned geometry at his desk, walked the streets interminably at his side, moved forward on the strength of his optimism and confidence. The boundless devotion to him of his wife Lily, to whom he was married from 1912 until her death in 1953, spilled over onto us to balm our institution-starved spirits, to lighten with gentle affection the bewilderment of our eccentricity and the unnatural confinement of our segregation. Upon a later generation of us, after the death of Lily, the same bounty was conferred in her turn by his sister, Emma Burnham, who lived with Doctor during the last 21 years of his life. As a forward youngster of 12, who made so bold as to address him as Doc, I was once thrown out of a class by Doctor with such a lecture as still rings in my ears. As a somewhat older youngster, still forward, but now also bored by the slow pace and unimaginative techniques of high school, I was expelled by him altogether for incorrigible recalcitrance. Eventually, despite these unpromising beginnings, I did graduate from high school. With plenty of ambition, but no money, I prepared to enter the university. At that point, I was denied state aid to the blind, a program then newly instituted as a result of Doctor's efforts in sponsoring a constitutional amendment and a comprehensive statute. Page 33. The reason was not that my need was not great. It was that I intended to pursue a higher education while I was being supported by the state. That was too much for the administrative officials. Almost without discussion, Doctor immediately filled the gap. Just as Waring Wilkinson had earlier done for him, he supplied me with tuition and living expenses out of his own pocket for a semester, while we all fought to reverse the decision of the state aid officials. It was ever thus with Doctor. The key to his great influence with blind students was, first of all, the fact that he was blind and therefore understood their problems, and second, that he believed in them and made his faith manifest. He provided the only sure foundation of true rapport, knowledge on our part that he was genuinely interested in our welfare. Aside from these immediate personal benefactions, there were three habits of life, one might almost say, three elements of personality, which I formed out of his teaching and example when I was an adolescent in his charge. First, an attitude toward my blindness, a conception that is basically unimportant in the important affairs of life. Page 34. A physical nuisance, yes. A topic of unembarrassed conversation, a subject of loud questions by small children in the street as you pass, certainly, but not something which shapes one's nature, which determines his career, which affects his usefulness or happiness. Second, a basic assumption that sighted people generally have boundless goodwill towards the blind and an utterly false conception of the consequences of blindness. Third, public activity as a rule of life, a sense of responsibility to exert personal effort to improve the lot of others. While I was still a lad in my teens, I was attending meetings and doing work that doctor assigned me in the blind movement. He was a social reformer. He made me one, too. Through participation with him, these attitudes and practices became habits of my life. So deeply instilled were they that they have remained ever after an almost automatic behavioral pattern, potent and often governing factors in my outlook and activity. Mature reflection in later years could only confirm through reason what his influence had so surely wrought in my youth. It is altogether fitting that we should hold this memorial convocation at the California School for the Blind. It was here that Newell Perry came in 1883 as a 10-year-old boy, penniless, blind, his father dead, his home dissolved. Page 35. 2 years earlier, he had lost his sight and nearly his life as a result of a case of poison oak, which held him in a coma for a month. It was here at the school that Waring Wilkinson first met and took and sick interest in him, laying the basis for future years of intimate relationship and mutual endeavor. Waring Wilkinson was the first principal of the California State School for the Deaf and the Blind. He served in that capacity for 44 years, from 1865 to 1909. With his characteristic interest in his charges, he soon saw young Newell's full potentiality. He sent him from here to Berkeley High School to complete his secondary education. It was he who overcame the numerous obstacles to this arrangement, so fruitful in its understanding of education and of the needs of the blind. Newell continued to live here at the school while he attended the University of California from 1892 to 1896. Again, admission had to be secured over strong resistance. Again, Wilkinson was the pathfinder, Newell his willing and anxious instrument. Wilkinson's role in Newell's life as a youth can hardly be overestimated. Father, teacher, guide, supporter, in Newell's own words, dear governor. Page 36. At this institution was not only the school but the home of his boyhood and the foundation of his manhood. So 16 years later, in 1912, at the age of 39, Newell Perry returned here to take up his permanent career as a teacher. He remained in that post until 1947, a third of a century. It was here that his life's work was accomplished. It was from this place as a base that he organized and conducted a movement for social reform. It was here that many of us first met him as his students. It was here that his impact upon us first made itself felt. It was here that our lifelong association with him began. How often in these halls have we heard his footsteps? How often in this chamber his voice? The sound of those footsteps and that voice have now gone from the world as a physical reality. How often hereafter will they continue to sound in the halls and chambers of our lives? In the years between departure from the school in 1896 and return to it in 1912, Newell Perry devoted himself to further education and to the search for an academic job. He took graduate work at the University of California, meanwhile serving successively as an unpaid teaching fellow, a paid assistant, and finally as an instructor in the Department of Mathematics. In 1900, following a general custom of that day, he went to Europe to continue his studies. He did this for a time at the University of Zurich in Switzerland and then at the University of Munich in Germany. From the latter, he secured the degree of Doctor of Philosophy in Mathematics with highest honors in 1901. He lingered in Europe for a time traveling and writing an article on a mathematical topic which was published in a learned journal. Page 37. He then returned to the United States in 1902, landing in New York, where he was to remain until 1912. He had about $80 in capital, a first-class and highly specialized education, and all the physical, mental, and personal prerequisites for a productive career, save one, visual acuity. During this period, he supported himself precariously as a private coach of university mathematics students. He applied himself also to the search for a university position. He had begun the process by mail from Europe even before he secured his Ph.D. He now continued the process on the ground in New York. He displayed the most relentless energy. He employed every imaginable technique. He wrote letters in profusion. In 1905, he wrote to 500 institutions of every size and character. He distributed his dissertation and published article. He haunted meetings of mathematicians. He visited his friends in the profession. He enlisted the aid of his teachers. He called on anybody and everybody having the remotest connection with his goal. Page 38. Everywhere the outcome was the same, only the form varied. Some expressed astonishment at what he had accomplished. Some expressed interest. One of these seemed genuine. He had a blind brother-in-law who, he said, was a whiz at math. Some showed indifference, now and then masked behind polite phrases. Some said there were no vacancies. Some said his application would be filed for future reference. One said for sick, what, ironically, as an encouragement to men who labor under disadvantages and who may learn from it how much may be accomplished through resolution and industry. Some averred that they, sick, probably could succeed in teaching at somebody else's college. Many said outright that they believe a blind man could not teach mathematics. Many of these rejections were, of course, perfectly proper. Many were not. Their authors candidly gave the reason as blindness. We know about this period of Newell Perry's life from reports of contemporaries or near contemporaries, such as Hugh Buckingham, a student at the school from 1896 to 1900 during Doctor's absence, who has prepared a manuscript about Doctor's boyhood and youth. Page 39. We know about it from what Doctor told many of us in later years, but we know about it in all its poignancy, desolation, and bleakness from Newell Perry's own intimate accounts, written at the time, to his old mentor and true friend, Waring Wilkinson. These accounts, with copies of many of the letters of rejection, have been preserved by the Wilkinson family through the intervening years. In the last 2 weeks, they have been opened to my inspection by Wilkinson's granddaughter, Florence Richardson Wyckoff, who is here with us today. I have dwelt on this period and these experiences for several reasons. They reflect, they accurately portray, a phase in all our lives as blind people. In fact, 35 years later, I personally received identical letters from many of these same institutions. It was almost as if a secretary had been set to copying doctor's file, only changing the signatures and the name of the addressee. Yet great progress has been made. Many of us are now teaching at colleges and universities around the country and filling many other jobs hitherto closed to us. Dr. Perry's reaction to this decade of defeat and privation was remarkable. He did not break. He did not resign. He did not even became sick, embittered. Page 40. Discouragement, frustration, a sense of wrong and injustice, certainly these, but never collapse. He was not licked. We see in these bitter years of hunger and rejection the source of true knowledge about the real problems of the blind and an ineradicable determination to do something about them. Here was a mainspring of social reform, an ever-flowing motivation to redirect public attitudes and actions toward the blind. To this was added the thrust of an active and restless disposition and the wit to perceive remedies and adapt them to the need. Out of these elements of mind, personality, and experience were compounded the public career of Newell Perry, and out of these elements also were constructed the programs and initiation of which made that career publicly significant. First of all, the distress of poverty must be relieved. The necessities of life must be available. The minimum essentials must be assured so much in some way had been provided in the Anglo-American system for three centuries before Newell Perry faced near starvation and economic exclusion in New York City. The Elizabethan Poor Laws did it in one way. County direct relief, instituted in California in 1901, did it in another. The almshouse and the county hospital and poor farm did it in still other ways. Page 41. At the very minimum, it had to be done better. It should be done by a system of cash grants, adequate in amount to maintain standards of eligibility made generally applicable, able, sick, by state participation and control, and expendable by the recipient through a free exercise of self-management and consumption choice. To bring this about, however, prohibitions in the state constitution would have, sic, be removed by the arduous process of a people's amendment. An organic statute would have to be lobbied through the state legislature. Faithful administration would somehow have to be secured. Year by year, and session by session, into the indefinite future, the myriad minor corrections and major improvements made necessary by time and disclosed by experience would have to be worked through the legislature and the administration. And so, indeed, it came to pass in California. Secondly, much more had to be done than merely relieve the distress of poverty. Security is a necessity. As an unmixed blessing, however, it is a stultifying concept. An indispensable ingredient of any welfare system is opportunity. One of the objects of public aid must be to stimulate and enable people to become independent of it. Accordingly, their initiative must not be hemmed in. Page 42. The means of productive activity must not be withdrawn or denied. Independence of action and self-reliance must be encouraged. Legal liability of relatives must be relaxed so as not to spread poverty, increase dependence, and disrupt family life. Economic resources, reasonable amounts of real and personal property must be devoted to plans for self-support instead of being required to be consumed in meeting daily needs. Incentive to earn must be constructed out of retention of the benefits of earning. And this, too, presently came to pass in California. The new system took cognizance of the need of the blind for adjustments on the social and psychological as well as the physical level. It permitted and encouraged them to strive to render themselves self-supporting. It applied the democratic principle of individual dignity to an underprivileged class of American citizens. It guaranteed them a fair measure of independence and self-respect in the conduct of their lives. The California system, the Newell Perry system, was thus far in advance of its time. It is still envied and emulated throughout the nation. Thirdly, the reintegration of the blind into society on a basis of full and equal membership could only be achieved if they had a chance to earn their daily bread as others do in the community. Page 43. Accordingly, action must be taken to eliminate restrictive barriers and legal discrimination. The main channels of opportunity must be swept clear of artificial and irrational obstructions. The public service, private employment, and common callings, the ordinary trades and occupations, the professions must be rescued from arbitrary exclusions based on blindness, when blindness is not a factor bearing on competence and performance. Doctor was a prime mover in securing legal, constitutional, and other provisions which protect the right of the blind to enter a number of professions. Forbid arbitrary discrimination against us in the state, civil service, and in secondary teaching. Enable blind college students to pursue their studies with the aid of sighted readers hired by the state. Bring the blind in an ever-increasing stream into the colleges and universities of the state, and thence into the higher callings. These achievements, legal, social, economic, and political, have been the fruits at once of Dr. Perry's leadership and of the collective self-organization of the blind which that leadership engendered. More than any other person, it was Doctor who implanted and nurtured among the blind of California the sense of common cause, the spirit of collaborative effort in seeking solutions to our problems. Page 44. More than any other person, it was he who taught us that the blind can and must lead the blind, and the sighted too, when dealing with the problems of the blind. More than any other person, it was he who made us aware that to go on unorganized was to remain disorganized, that only through concerted action can the blind hope to convert and enlist the power of government and to defeat the thoughtless tyranny of public prejudice and opportune ignorance. Newell Perry was a teacher of subject matter and a teacher of men. He taught his specialty of mathematics and taught it very well indeed, but he taught his pupils even better. To be sure, not all the students who came his way during his 35 years on this campus were wholly inspired by him. His personality was vigorous, and his standards rigorous. But for many of us who attended the school during those 3.5 decades, it was Dr. Perry who furnished the impetus and incentive, the goad and the goal, that would light our later lives and nourish our careers. Our bond with him was not broken when our school days ended. We went on to become his comrades and colleagues in the cause which was always his true vocation. Newell Perry was, in short, both a teacher of youth and a leader of men. Page 45. These two roles were not, however, quite separate. For the secret of his success in both of them lay in this, that his teaching was a kind of leadership, and in his social purpose Doctor was thoroughly Socratic. His classroom manner was essentially that of the Platonic dialogue, dialectical, inquiring, insistently logical, and incessantly prodding. In this Socratic combination also lies, I think, the secret of Doctor's success as the leader of a social movement. Just as in the classroom he taught his students by leading them, so as the pioneer of the organized blind movement he led his followers by teaching them. His power, like that of all leaders, rested in the last analysis on persuasion. His triumphs, however, were not the product of oratorical or literary skill, although he had a notable gift for trenchant and incisive phrasing, the epigrammatic thrust which distills the essence of a complex issue. His persuasive power was not that of the demagogue, but of the pedagogue, and it was not only his followers who learned from him. He educated the general public by his preachment and his example to regard the blind not in the traditional terms of charity and custody, but in the realistic terms of normality and equality. And, most of all, in his role as leader, Newell Perry educated, indoctrinated, and persuaded a distinguished group of cohorts to join him in carrying on the struggle and carrying out its goals. Page 46. Those whom Doctor fathered around him were blind men and women, mostly former students, whose special talents and professional positions uniquely supplemented his. Raymond Henderson, by profession an attorney, self-taught, by preoccupation a reformer, with poetry in his soul and literature in his stylus. Born in 1881, he attended this school from 1889 through high school and continued to live here until his graduation from the University of California in 1914. He practiced his profession in Bakersfield, California, from his admission to the bar until his death in 1945. Raymond came to the organized blind movement in his maturity from a long background of experience in other causes. He brought to it a notable array of personal abilities, a high degree of professional skill, a fine spirit of humanity, and the enrichment of wide and intensive activity. Leslie Schlingheide, also by profession an attorney, gentle and religious by disposition, practical rather than reflective in a frame of mind, with a brilliant academic record and a liberal outlook, He was born in 1893, attended this school from 1906 to 1913, and thus came under doctor's influence in the year of his graduation. Page 47. He received a J.D. from the Law School of the University of California in 1920, and from that time until his death in 1957, practiced his profession in Modesto, California, and served the blind movement all over the state. It was Raymond Henderson and Leslie Schlingheide who were primarily responsible for handling cases in court, for preparing innumerable legal briefs and arguments, for drafting projected bills and constitutional amendments, for continuous legal counsel during the insurgent and formative years. They were in a real sense the legal arm of the organized blind movement. Ernest Crowley, again by profession an attorney, but distinguished for his service in another area. He kept a law office open in Fairfield, Sassoon, from the time of his graduation from the University of California Law School in 1923 until his death in 1952. To him, however, the law was only a necessary and not a particularly attractive means of earning a living. His law office was a cover for his real love and active life, the practice of politics. He was born in 1896 and attended this school from 1910 to 1916. He was thus under doctor's tutelage as a student for 4 years. His significant contribution was made as a member of the state legislature from 1928 to 1952. It was he who introduced and skillfully maneuvered through to passage the memorable bills which are now the statutory landmarks of our movement. Page 48. In a very real sense, he was the legislative spokesman and arm of the movement. Perry Sundquist, social worker and public administrator by profession, bringing to his work a sympathetic personality, an unshakable faith in blind people, and skillful management of administrative techniques and devices. He was born in 1904 and attended this school from 1918 to 1922. For exactly 20 years now, he has been chief of the Division for the Blind in the State Department of Social Welfare. During those 2 decades, he has translated the principles of the organized blind movement into concrete administrative action, from legislative parchment into practical reality. Under his direction, programs for the blind have multiplied and prospered, services have been expanded, and their benefits spread. Most important of all, the working philosophy of the movement has been transformed into a working practice. In a very real sense, he has been the effective administrative arm of the movement. Through the years, this little band grew in numbers and evolved in formal structure. It formed the nucleus of the California Council of the Blind, which came into being in 1934 with Dr. Perry as its first president. Page 49. For 19 productive years, until his retirement in 1953 at the age of 80, Dr. forged and shaped the council on the anvil of his own will into an instrument larger and more formidable, but essentially similar to the informal group from which it originated. Dr.'s social vision in the field of blind welfare outdistanced his time and placed him in the advance guard of thought and planning. His liberality of these matters gains rather than loses in significance when it is placed alongside his broader attitudes toward politics and human affairs, for in matters unrelated to the blind, Dr. was fully an heir of the 19th century conservative, even reactionary by nature, often inflexible and not without a touch of old-fashioned nationalist imperialism. When it came to the cause to which he was most committed, he was far less a Victorian than a utopian, less a stand-patter than a restless progressive in search of new horizons. How shall we sum up a man's life? How capture the essential quality of a human career? How convey the inward meaning, the imponderable and intangible qualities of will and heart and spirit? There are the vital statistics, but they are more statistical than vital. All that they can tell us of a man is that he was born, he lived, he loved, he died. For Newell Perry, we must amend the litany at least this much. He lived, and he brought new life to many. He loved, and he was beloved. He died, and he will not be forgotten. On the day following the death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Walter Lippmann wrote some words about him, which might also stand as an epitaph to the leader and comrade whom we honor today. The man must die in his appointed time. He must carry away with him the magic of his presence and that personal mastery of affairs which no man, however gifted by nature, can acquire except in the relentless struggle with evil and blind chance. Then comes the proof of whether his work will endure, and the test of how well he led his people. The final test of a leader is that he leaves behind him, in other men, the conviction and the will to carry on. Page 50. California Council of the Blind, CCB, Strategic Plan 2013 to 2016, by Board of Directors. Editor's Note, from President Jeff Tom. Whether you are a Fortune 500 company or a small nonprofit like CCB, without a rudder to guide the ship, you are at great risk of floundering and running aground. That is why the CCB Board of Directors, under the leadership of President Pomerantz, has adopted a strategic plan that contains specific goals and objectives that, if we can achieve them, will enable us over the next few years to expand our financial resources, increase membership, improve the way we run our organization, and, in general, become better able to improve the lives of Californians who are blind or have low vision. Achievement of these goals and objectives will take commitment and effort from all of us. Task forces are being established to spearhead the implementation of each goal in the strategic plan. Thus, I urge you to take a close look at the elements of the strategic plan and determine in what ways you can help in its implementation. This issue contains the first goal. The other three will follow in subsequent issues. Page 51. Mission. After some discussion about the mission of CCB, the mission statement was modified to read as follows. The mission of the California Council of the Blind, CCB, is to gain full independence and equality of opportunity for all blind and low-vision Californians. This revised mission statement should be approved by the board and substituted for the present mission in all documents and on the website. Goal number one, to implement a resource development strategy to end the erosion of our resources. Page 52. Objective number one, the easy stuff, doable without cost. The following information is organized in four columns with the headings Activities, Responsible Party, Time Frame, and Costs. Under Activities, first, A, maximize website for more effective fundraising. Responsible Party, Webmaster. Time frame, none indicated. Costs, minimal, volunteer time. Activities, A1. Construct a better and repeating throughout website a donate button. Responsible Party, Webmaster. Time frame, September 1, 2014. Costs, minimal, volunteer time. Activities, B. Revise and or create marketing opportunities to increase funds. Responsible Party, Task Force. Time frame, none indicated. Costs, none. Activities, B. 1. Solicit ads on website and in publications. Responsible Party, Task Force. Time frame, July 1, 2014, ongoing. Costs, none. Activities, C. Seek bequests by subscribing to the Estate Lawyer's Book. Responsible Party, Task Force, Time Frame, May 1, 2014. Costs, minimal. Activities, D, strongly promote monthly automatic giving. MMS for members and general public. Responsible Party, Task Force initiated. Time Frame, major initiative to begin July 1, 2014, ongoing. Costs, volunteer time. Activities, E, identify needs and seek in-kind giving. Responsible Party, board, staff, identify needs, task force explores sources. time frame, as needs are identified, potential donors sought. Costs, volunteer time, July 1, 2014, ongoing. Activities F. Find a successful nonprofit to mentor CCB. Responsible party, task force gathers potential nonprofit ideas from board, members, and makes request. Time frame, October 1, 2014, ongoing. Cost, volunteer time. Page 53. Objective number 2, better utilizing people resources. Activities, A, develop a relationship with SCORE. Responsible party, task force, time frame, August 15, 2014, ongoing, cost, none. Activities, B, form an advisory council for business advice and financial support, chair and treasurer ex officio. Responsible party, task force coordinates with help from CCB's CPA and others with desired skills, contacts. Contact CPA, solicit his help, write a job description, and begin formulating a membership list. Time frame, January 1, 2016, hold first council meeting chaired by task force member. Cost, none. Activities, C, attempt to find a corporation that would loan us an executive. Responsible party, task force, Don to contact Cisco when asked, advisory council. Time frame, on agenda for first council meeting, January 1, 2016. Cost, none. Activities, D, create a Friends of CCB who become regular donors. Responsible party, task force, time frame, none. Cost, none indicated. Page 54. Objective number 3, hire a full-time executive director fundraiser. Activities, A, explore the feasibility of using our temporarily restricted funds. Responsible party, task force with friendly attorney. Time frame, July 2013, begin investigation. Costs, minimal. Activities B, construct a strong case, supported by the board, for the need to hire. Responsible party, task force and board. Time frame, September 2013. Costs, none. Activities C, write job description and proceed with hiring process. Responsible party, task force and board. Time frame, October 2013. Costs, none. Activities D, develop specific objectives for ED's year one. Responsible party, task force and board approval. Time frame, November 2013. Costs, none. Activities E, hire ED fundraiser. Responsible party, board. Time frame, December 2013. Costs, approximately $75,000 a year. Activities F, evaluate ED's performance to date. Responsible party, task force, board. Time frame, July 2014. Costs, none. Page 55. Objective number 4, more aggressively explore business opportunities. Activities A, obtain contracts or consulting opportunities using our unique skills and knowledge. Responsible party, task force. Time frame, October 1, 2015. Costs, none. Activities B, explore operating a business to generate income, like CSB's Braille fortune cookies. Responsible party, task force and advisory council. Time frame, April 1, 2015, preliminary report. Cost, none. Activities C, purchase an income-producing piece of real estate. Responsible party, task force and advisory council. Time frame, January 1, 2017. Cost, none. Objective number 5, fundraising initiatives. Activities A, continue to actively grow Muttstrut. Responsible party, task force with Muttstrut coordinators. Time frame, May 19, 2014, ongoing. Costs, none unless a professional promoter is hired. Activities B, identify a second big fundraiser to complement Muttstrut. Responsible party, task force with input from membership and board. Time frame, January 1, 2015. Costs, none. Activities C, find angel charities who will donate a portion of their fundraising events to CCB. Responsible party, task force and advisory council. Time frame, July 1, 2015. Costs, none. Activities D, apply for a capacity building grant of approximately $150,000. responsible party, task force research possibilities, and perhaps hire grant writer on contract basis. Time frame, none indicated. Cost of grant writer approximately $20,000 or less. Activities, E. Conduct cost-benefit analysis of all current and future fundraisers. Responsible party, task force, time frame, November 1, 2014, costs, none. Page 56. California Council of the Blind, 2014 Officers and Board. Editor's note, we are indebted to Bernice Kandarian, who updates and corrects the list of CCB officers and board members, including the number of the term each is presently serving, the year elected to that term, and the year next up for election. Terms begin on July 1 following election. The presence of an asterisk means that the individual served a partial term before the first full term. Page 57. President Jeff Tom, 14 to 16 first term, Sacramento, California, 95831, 916-995-3967, cell, jeff.tom@ccbnet.org. First Vice President Eugene Lozano, Jr., asterisk 14 to 16, fourth term, Sacramento, California, 95841, eugene.lozano@ccbnet.org. Second Vice President Roger Peterson, asterisk 13 to 15, second term, Mountain View, California, 94040, 650-969-1688, home, roger.peterson@ccbnet.org. Secretary Judy Wilkinson, 13 to 15, first term, San Leandro, California, 94577, 510-388-5079, cell, judy.wilkinson@ccbnet.org. Page 58, Treasurer Peter Pardini, 14 to 16, third term, Mill Valley, California, 94941, 415-990-9202, cell, peter.pardini@ccbnet.org. Immediate past president, Donna Pomerantz, 14 to question marks, Pasadena, California, 91106-3036, 626-844-4388, home, donna.pomerantz@ccbnet.org. Board of Directors, Artis Bazin, asterisk 13 to 15, second term, Burbank, California, 91504, ardis.bazyn@ccbnet.org. Vincent Calderon, asterisk 14 to 16, fourth term, Montclair, California, 91763, 626-429-4539, cell, vince.calderon@ccbnet.org. Lena Dawes, asterisk 14 to 16, third term, Sacramento, California, 95818, 916-905-9034, cell, leena.dawes@ccbnet.org. Paul Patch, Jr., 14 to 16, first term, Sacramento, California, 95833, 916-662-0861, cell, paul.patche@ccbnet.org. Page 59. Linda Porell, 13 to 15, third term, San Francisco, California, 94112, 415-577-8437, cell, linda.porelle@ccbnet.org. John Ross, 13 to 15, first term, Bakersfield, California, 93306. 661-619-5863, cell. john.ross@ccbnet.org. Frank Welty, 14 to 16 first term, San Leandro, California, 94577, 510-541-1442, cell. frank.welte@ccbnet.org. Robert Wendt, 13 to 15, second term, Long Beach, California, 90814. 562-438-7100, home. robert.wendt@ccbnet.org. Vita Zavoli, 13 to 15, first term, San Leandro, California, 94577. vita.zavoli@ccbnet.org. Page 60, Publications Committee, Linda Porell, Chair, San Francisco, California, 94112, 415-577-8437, cell, linda.porelle@ccbnet.org. Judy Wilkinson, Editor, San Leandro, California, 94577, 510-357-1844, home, editor@ccbnet.org. Other members, Annette Carter, Susan Glass, Mike Keithley, Roger Peterson, Bonnie Rennie, Donna Sanchez, Dr. Catherine Schmidt-Whitaker.